His website is publicparticipation.com. And we're here today to talk about his book, Loving Through Your Differences, Building Strong Relationships from Separate Realities. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
Thanks for being with us today. So let's talk about this. We get with a partner, and then we find out we get with a partner because we love all the things that we have in common, and then it turns out that they're really different from us.
Yeah. How dare they? Yeah. This is often couples get together on the basis of similarities and commonalities and so on. And yet it's inevitable that they will hit things where they have different reactions to the same thing. In fact, that's one of the core messages in the book, is that each of us has an emotional reality of our own that is unique and which nobody else in the universe has. And so it's inevitable that we're going to have different feelings in response to the same thing. I think sometimes some simple thing like my wife and I go to a movie, and I think it's a fun movie, and she's bored out of her gourd, and she doesn't like car chases. And so we, after the movie, we start to compare notes. And if I say, oh, that was a great movie, she might fire back with something that would indicate how adolescent I was to enjoy a movie like that. And with that, we're off and running. If we got back to reality, though, the reality is that I enjoyed it and she was bored. That fundamental reality is there regardless of whatever judgments we're going to make about it. So that a lot of what we're trying to do in this book is deal with when you have a difference that's rooted in emotional reality, then how do you deal with it? Because while it seems kind of simple and silly when it's going to the movie, it's anything but if you're talking about spending money, raising kids, sex, on and on and on. All of things which we could have individual differences.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like with the movie example, one person might be saying, that was the greatest movie, and the other person says, no, that movie was horrible. And really, those are just subjective opinions. But the facts are that you enjoyed it and she didn't, and it's more important to stick to the facts rather than our value judgments.
Yeah, and the facts being what we experienced, and I experienced pleasure, she experienced boredom. The reason that's important is when you're communicating with someone about your feelings, it's really important to share feelings. Hurt, angry, sad, frustrated, worried, so forth and so on, rather than judgments, inconsiderate, ridiculous, etc., so forth and so on. And often what happens is the first words out of our mouth come across as some sort of blame and accusation, and then we're off to the races. We escalate and escalate and escalate, and some silly little thing like the cap was left off the toothpaste can destroy a relationship with a little bit of work.
Mm. So I'm wondering how yesterday I think I did that. So I'm going through a breakup with a partner who violated agreements that we had. And throughout all of it, it was more about his feelings, how he felt. He felt bad, but he didn't do anything to soothe me or make me feel better. And so yesterday we were talking and I said, you know, through this whole thing, it's just all been about you. You've made it all about you. And as I'm hearing what you're saying, it sounds like that wasn't really maybe the most accurate or effective way to phrase that. Can you suggest like a more based on loving through your differences type of vocabulary, how might you express that sentiment?
Well, I would confine it to your experiences and feelings. So if you felt betrayed, if you felt hurt or abandoned or rejected or lonesome or whatever it was, that you stay with that and stay off of what's wrong with him.
Mm-hmm.
The minute you get onto what's wrong with him, he's going to fire back with what's wrong with you, and away you go.
So if someone punches me in the face, I still have to say, well, this is about me being hurt, not about the fact that you just broke the law and my nose.
This is not a turn the other cheek philosophy. It's simply, if you want to establish and maintain a relationship with someone, then it helps if you lead with feelings rather than with judgments.
Okay.
Because if you lead with judgments, what will happen is that they will simply fire back with their judgments of you, and away you go. So I can't really deal with the somebody slugs you in the nose thing. I would be more inclined to call the cops or so on. Now, if you slug them back, then that gives them permission to, you know, start hitting you again and again and again and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. So in that situation, that's not a situation where you're wanting to actually engage in a healthy discussion. But if it's something more emotional, then talking about the hurt and the pain and the disappointment that I felt is better than saying you did this.
Yeah. If it's accusation of him, it's rare that someone can hear a lot of accusation without firing back with counter accusation, and away we go.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So you talk about there's so much to your book. What do you feel like is the most important thing to start with? Because I just kind of jumped right in there. But yeah, let's talk more about your book.
Well, why don't we kind of use what we've been talking about? Let me go back to the toothpaste cap. What happens is there's kind of an escalation, a ladder of escalation, and you start out with the toothpaste cap, but if it comes across as blaming, accusing, the issue tends to get expanded to you're thoughtless and inconsiderate and sloppy and lazy and so forth, and then it expands to bringing in other people as ammunition. It's not just me that feels this way. Your mother said, all the neighbors took a vote, whatever it is, until you're up at the top of the ladder of escalation, which is where the point of the game becomes to hurt each other physically or emotionally. And I mean, it's kind of a lost cause when it reaches that stage and so on. So part of the book is trying to identify what are the behaviors that cause escalation, and then try to set some rules as a couple to put limits on behaviors you engage in that may cause a situation to escalate. So for example, my wife and I have created a rule, which is that we won't expand the issue. So if the problem is the cap's left off the toothpaste, and I start in on she's messy or something like that, she can call me on it and point out that I've just expanded the issue. And grudgingly, I'll pull myself back down to whatever the original issue is. We also have a rule not to use other people as ammunition, because what's observable is if I claim so-and-so said something, a couple things happen. One, I ruin the relationship with the other person, the person that I'm claiming said something. But more than that, she'll simply fire back with, well, it's not just me, it's, and she'll claim three people she knows who felt the same way. So,
but that's just showing all the evidence against you. How are we supposed to win the fight without everybody chiming in on what they think?
Well, is the name of the game to win the fight or to maintain a relationship?
Exactly.
And that's one way of thinking about it is he comes to the relationship with his kind of with the rules of his family. Unconsciously, we mostly adopt styles of dealing with conflict that we learned in our family from parents and other adults and so on. So he comes with his rules and she comes with her rules, and they're both reacting to unconscious rules that they don't even know they have. And my experience is the only way you can escape that is that you have to set our rules, so that you have to have rules that you consciously agree on and are willing to stick with.
But then, so it sounds like you and your wife have these rules, and if one of them, one of you oversteps the rule, then the other one, it's their responsibility to say, hey, you're overstepping this rule that we agreed on. And then you come back and say, okay, you're right, and stick to the facts of what you're talking about. But even though I think we kind of know that we're supposed to do that, but how often do couples actually stick to that?
Well, they have it. Let's put it this way. All couples fight, in my experience, and some fight a little bit and some fight a lot. And my wife and I were on the fight a lot end of the scale. And I might mention we've been married 53 years, so I guess we're going to make it. And what we would do is just wail away and then end up in really bad places. And the best time I found to set rules was we just had a fight. We're both hurting. We don't want to go there again, and so on. We'll agree to rules under those circumstances. And it may take a couple times through before we really stick with the rules and so on. But we do, because we find it helps. It works. It keeps us from getting in the really horrible places that you can get to when things escalate.
And it sounds like also you mentioned this in your book that you will reassess the rules, because you might have the best of intentions, both of you, and say, this is a rule that's really going to serve us. And then the practice of it might still need some ironing out.
Yeah, they're your rules. So if you don't like the way that one worked, change it so it works for you. The big idea is that you get agreements on the rules so that they are your rules, rather than just unconsciously move from whatever your family did.
So I'm curious, Jim, do you and your wife have a list of rules written down somewhere, or do you just remember them?
We just remember them. And there's one kind of super emergency rule that we have that works for us. In the book, I talk a lot about listening and listening skills, including a skill called active listening that's very helpful. And yet I find active listening is very hard to do with the person you love. It's just like you don't have the emotional space inside to accommodate their feelings as well as your own. And a therapist friend of ours taught us a simple little technique called the 5-minute rule. And the way the 5-minute rule works is, if you start to sense that you're beginning to escalate, either one of you can invoke the 5-minute rule. And the 5-minute rule is kind of a super rule, in that you stop dead whatever you're doing. The only thing you're allowed to talk about is who goes first. That person then, and you flip a coin if you can't agree, and that person goes first for 5 minutes and gets to say whatever they want, however they want, preferably without any loud body language coming back or anything like that, in return for which then you rotate. The other person gets 5 minutes to say whatever he or she needs to say. And if you're not done at the end of 5 minutes, you can do another 5-minute round and so on. The reason it works is because what keeps arguments going on and on and on and on is every 30 seconds or so, somebody's telling the other person they're bad, stupid, or crazy for feeling the way they do. You're being contradicted, and so you have to come back and counter the argument and so forth and so on. It goes on and on and on. 5 minutes is long enough that you usually can get out enough that the steam kind of goes out from it. I find, in fact, that at about 4 minutes, I'm beginning to bore even myself. But sometimes you'll need a second round, and it may not end spectacularly. It may end with just, I don't have any more to say. Or sometimes one of the other businesses now gotten enough feelings out that we're making some conciliatory gestures, like, yeah, I guess I could pick up more often, or something or other that begins to mend the hurt that's forming. The principle, though, is that people need to be heard without interruption, and if they are, it goes from, it's a lot like water going down a hose. If there's blockage in a hose and you put the water on, the pressure just builds and builds and builds and builds. Finally, when the water is able to get past the blockage, it may go splash for a while, but eventually it's clean, clear stuff comes through. And what we find is most people think if people are allowed to say something and it isn't contradicted, that somehow they're going to feel that way for the rest of their life. But in reality, feelings change far more rapidly when they're accepted than when they're contradicted. Resist a feeling and you'll get resistance back.
So are you sitting there, because I feel like if I was to let someone who's upset just kind of say it all, just verbal diarrhea, all of it at me for 5 minutes, I feel like I would have to physically cover my mouth to stop myself from like defending, because they're so, you know, if their feelings are not in alignment with my perception of what I feel I've done, you know, it's only natural that you would want to correct that. But in this exercise, you're not doing that. So do you find people actually cover their mouths, or is it easy to just not talk?
If you have to cover your mouth, cover your mouth. But it helps that you know that the name of the game is you're not going to say anything, and that there's a rule in effect. And in effect, you lose some standing if you do break the rule. There are ways of communicating your feelings we talked about earlier that are more likely to be heard. The other person can hear more readily and so on. But we don't even try that in the 5 minute rule. The ground rule is anything they want, any way they want. And the reason being that if you start correcting them, you know, like, oh, you should have said that this way, or should have said that way, and so on, pretty soon you're off to the races again.
Mm-hmm. And then the person, I mean, it sounds like the part of it is to allow those emotions to flow out of you, to feel like you've been heard. And then that way, with acceptance that that's how the person feels in this moment, they're able to move on and not necessarily feel as negatively.
Yeah, if nothing else, the intensity goes out of it. That feeling you get of, I just have to convince him that such and such and so on. So it's what really occurred. So the intensity goes out of it. But as you release your feelings, you may find you feel differently. Your feelings may change during that 5 minutes as well. You don't always end up in exactly where you thought you were going to end up, because as you talk about it, things come in and your feelings begin to change because you're now releasing them rather than hanging on to them.
Now, what if you're with someone who, even though you try to present this, I mean, it's all well and good to have a book and to say, hey, let's do this, let's make our relationship better. But if you're with someone who's just not willing to play ball, they're not willing to validate your feelings or to speak in a more effective way, where do you go from there?
Yeah, that one's tough. Just because my image of what would happen would be that you'd both read the book and then you'd go back and you work through it chapter by chapter and come up with your own agreements for how you're going to handle situations, including possibly writing them down, as you suggested earlier. If they're not willing to accept any limits on their behavior, you may need to ask, do I belong in this relationship? But if they're willing to try to work it through, then then the relationship has promise, and you may be able to come up with something that works for you two particularly. So, and that's the whole idea, is that whatever ground rules you come up with have to be something that two of you feel good about.
Fair enough. So it sounds like this book is intended for people who are willing to work together to come up with solutions.
Yes, it's some of the skills that are in the book are useful just by yourself, but the real goal of the book is for a couple that's having problems about handling their differences to be able to develop some skills and agreements that will help them through that.
We are speaking right now with Dr. James L. Creighton. He is the author of Loving Through Your Differences, Building Strong Relationships from Separate Realities. And you can find his website at publicparticipation.com. So, Jim, you mentioned that some of the skills in the book can be used on your own. And we were talking about how sometimes partners are not as willing to work together to find solutions. But I imagine if you're starting to use some of these skills, like the active listening, like stopping the blame and the judgment and just talking about your feelings, you're more likely to get a better result from someone who even at the start is resistant.
That's right. And as I said before, for my wife and I, the best time to get agreements to try certain rules was, we just had a fight. It hurt. We don't like to feel that hurt. We're trying to patch things up and so on after the fight, and that's a time where we're in touch enough with the fact that it hurts that we're willing to put some limits on our behavior and so on. So ironically, right after the fight is one of the better times to get agreement on how you're going to handle your next fight. That, by the way, runs against the way most people treat fights. Most of the time they treat fights as something strange that happened to them and it's never going to happen again, or they're going to try to pretend it's never going to happen again and so on, instead of planning for it. And inherent in the kind of approach that's there is fights are inevitable, and if they're hurting, then you need to agree on limits and agree on skills that you're going to use and so forth, because they will come up again and you'll need them.
I imagine though, after a fight though, a lot of times people are quite exhausted and don't have a lot of mental energy. So what do you do about that?
Well, you'll have to judge that yourselves. All I can share in my experience, one of the richest times for getting agreements and so on was in that after the fight thing. People make up in funny ways. My wife and I, for example, just had one act that we did after a fight when we weren't really happy with each other yet, but we wanted to acknowledge that we were still together. We would cross our little fingers, or put our hands, our little fingers together and so on. It was saying, I'm not all the way back and I'm not all the way feeling super good, but I want to acknowledge that we're together and I don't intend to go anywhere. And I love you and we'll get back together somehow, somewhere. You'll have to find for yourself what's a good time. The other way to use the book would be to get a third person. Both my wife and I have used therapists at various times. And a third person can provide some rules and some structure and so forth and so on. If you did this, you want a therapist though who works on this kind of thing. You're not going for psychoanalysis, you're going for help with specific communication skills.
Fair enough. Thank you, Jim. Now, you talk about the importance of defining the problem, and because you've worked with corporations and businesses and governments, and a lot of time, I know if anyone who sat through a useless meeting in a company, nothing gets accomplished. So how do you go about defining the actual problem?
Well, it is a key. In the book, I outline a simple problem-solving process, of which the first step is define the problem. And I would note that often, let's keep it at the level of a couple for just a second, level of a couple that are in a family, ostensibly the issue is how do we solve transportation problems in our family, getting everybody to their various activities and jobs and so on. Sometimes that's the problem, but the other thing that can come up is that there's can be a relationship problem underneath that, which is somebody feels like everybody else's needs are getting met and theirs aren't. And if you address that problem, sometimes the objective transportation problem just kind of goes away on its own. But I do find that groups have a tendency to skip right over. So I saw a parent teachers association meeting a while back where somebody was expressing a concern about drugs, and they started talking about that. And somebody said, "Oh, I saw a great movie. We should show the kids." And then somebody said, "Well, it's going to cost money to rent the movie, and we haven't got any money." And then they came up with, "Well, let's have a bake sale." By the end of the meeting, they'd organized the heck out of a bake sale. I have no idea whether it did any good for drugs or whatever. they just jump straight to a solution. And I find the same thing happens in business. They once they see a solution they like, they jump to that solution, whether it solves the problem or not. So you do need to spend time defining the problem and accepting that there can be emotional relationship issues that can be as big or bigger than the supposed subject matter of it. The reason I go through a problem-solving process, in addition to building in some kind of principles of conflict resolution, is that if you both know what the steps are and you're kind of going through them together step by step, you know where you are in the process. So if you start to get ahead with coming up with all kinds of solutions and you haven't yet defined the problem, one or the other, you may be sharp enough to say, "Hey, you know, we don't have a problem definition yet. We need to back up and deal with it." And both people, they understand why that's worth doing.
Hmm. How often, I've noticed this, sometimes people will come up with what they think is the problem on their own without consulting with the other person. Like, I once dated a guy who decided if we were going to be married, he was going to sell his house and buy a condo in another town because he thought I would be happier in this other place. Without even asking me, he'd made this whole like, huge decision.
Yeah, that can happen. And I've also seen it, even when you agree on something, I've seen it happen where family agreed that they were going to buy a new car, and the husband went out and bought one and came back with it without him consulting his wife and so on. Those kinds of things do happen. So the whole point of the problem solving process is that it's mutual problem solving, and you haven't gotten to a solution unless you've gotten to an agreement.
Okay. Can we validate how incredibly frustrating that would be to have an agreement and then have dude go out and buy a car without consulting the next day?
You maybe feel doubly betrayed because you, like I was stupid enough to problem solve with you, and it still happened.
Yeah. But so what do you do in that circumstance? You don't blame and say, "Oh my gosh, what a insensitive jerk." What do you say instead?
Well, you say, "I feel betrayed, hurt, resentful, left out." Those kinds of feelings. You communicate them loudly and clearly and so forth. Actually, most places, I think you have 3 days to take a car back after, you know, 3 days to rescind the decision, but that's something you'd have to agree on too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So when also you mentioned we're talking about problems and then solving problems, and I really loved your idea of brainstorming a ton of ideas without judgments. Can we talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, that's the steps in the problem-solving process. You define the problem, then you brainstorm a list of solutions. And the ground rule in brainstorming is that you go for lots of possible ideas, including really goofy, crazy ones, so that everybody has, instead of coming into a situation where he has his preferred solution and she has her preferred solution, and then they battle it out. If each of you has five possible solutions on the list, you don't have that same sense of ownership and same sense of I've got to defend this to the death and so on. But also studies of creativity have shown that groups that come up with lots of potential solutions are more likely to come up with creative solutions than groups that just do kind of the time-honored and time-worn. And so that if you had one group comes up with 10 possibilities and one comes up with 20, the group that comes up with 20 is not only more likely to come up with the creative solution, but the creative solutions are more likely to come up in between 10 and 20 in the last part, because you've broken loose on your thinking about that.
And Jim, what was I going to say? Yeah, you also mentioned that if there's other people with a stake in this decision, like the kids, you should probably get their input as well if it's age appropriate.
Yeah, that's if you have three people involved in a problem and A and B get together and agree on something and go to C and say we solved the problem, C doesn't think so.
Yeah.
One of the first steps in group problem solving, in companies and dealing with the public and so forth, is you have to define who the stakeholders are. Because the thing you don't want to do is leave stakeholders out and have them feel doubly betrayed, not just by the outcome, but because they weren't included. And so, yes, you have to sit down and think through who's going to be impacted and so on. So, for example, our discussion of the family that had a transportation problem, it's entirely appropriate if it affects the kids getting to their activities, or if the solution might involve their having to give up something that they wanted, like new football equipment or going to piano lessons once a week instead of twice a week and so forth. Excuse me, they need to be included in that discussion. Now, once you've decided you're going to buy a new car, I don't expect the children to decide what the monthly payment should be or something like that. You've got to, their contribution would be, hey, that's pretty cool. And that's about the limit of what they would be able to offer you.
Okay. So, and I imagine that if everybody's involved, then if it's the case of, yeah, we can't, you might have to go to one fewer hockey practice a week or whatever it may be. If everybody's involved in the problem solving and everybody's willing to make a sacrifice for the good of the family, then it's like you're volunteering to say, oh, I could do one less practice a week, rather than that decision being inflicted on you.
Yeah, if you go to the kids and say, you are going to give up one practice a week and so forth, they're going to be angry and upset and so forth. If they volunteer to give up the one thing, then they feel good about it and good about themselves.
Beautiful. We are speaking right now with James L. Creighton. He is the author of Loving Through Your Differences, Building Strong Relationships from Separate Realities. You can find him on his website, publicparticipation.com. So, Jim, what's one of the skills that you are most excited about?
Okay. One of the things that intrigues me, and I'm just exploring it myself. I haven't really gone all the way with it yet. Is a skill called reframing. And what I mean by reframing is the implicit in everything we're saying is that feelings are a function not just of what happens out there, but how you interpret it. Since I inevitably will interpret it different than you will, inevitably we will end up with slightly different feelings and sometimes significantly different feelings and so on. So reality is the external event plus the interpretation we put on the event. Now, the reason that's important is because the context in which you interpret the other's behavior has your set of meanings on it. So, for example, had a guy in a class who liked to go hunting with the guys. And every few months he'd take off. And when he got home, his wife would hit him with all kinds of questions. And did you go there and see that? And it was clear to him that she was feeling jealous and so forth and so on. And he would react to that. And he'd get angry and resentful and feel controlled. And on and on and on it would go. And it had gotten to the point that he was about ready to abandon going on the trips, but then he'd get so resentful about that was a problem. So he was working on reframing it, and what he realized was that her asking all the questions and so forth was really a way she was saying, I'm feeling insecure, and I'm worried whether you really love me, and whether you really want to be with me, and so forth and so on. And he found that if he acted reassuring and lovingly towards her, which is the way you would react towards somebody who felt insecure, that the questions didn't happen. That the questions were a communication of, I'm scared, I'm insecure, I don't know where I stand with you, so forth and so on. So one frame of, she's jealous and she's trying to check up on me and so forth, would lead him to act in a way that would hurt the relationship. Whereas if he reframed it as she's feeling insecure and uncertain and so forth, then his behavior was different and they'd often end up in a good loving place. So I'm intrigued with kind of what are the outer limits and how do you learn to reframe, because a lot of our frames were set up when we were kids, and we're not even aware of them. They're kind of like rules we don't know we had. I had an example of this. Couple wanted to buy a new car, and he came from a family where it was an immigrant family, and it was really important for them to show the world that they had arrived. They were a success and they belonged here and they were a valuable member of the community. And so he wanted to look at Mercedes-Benz. She, on the other hand, was raised in a working class family where one of the important rules was to never get above yourself. And to certain cars were ostentatious and pretentious and so forth and so on. So every time she got in the Mercedes-Benz, she felt completely uncomfortable and like she was betraying her family and so forth. Both of them had a frame that they were bringing to selecting the car, and those two frames were making it really tough for them to agree on a particular car. And it didn't really have much to do with the car. It had to do with how are we going to negotiate these frames. Now, both of them can use that as a learning. They can say, hey, here's a frame I didn't realize I had, and I'm spending all my life trying to impress people to show I've arrived, or I'm spending all my life trying to show people that I'm not above myself and so forth, maybe those frames don't work anymore. And maybe I can begin to come up with a new frame. And so I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued with the whole thing, because I think that's one of the keys to working through differences, is that you really work together until you find a common frame that allows the behaviors that you need to work it out.
Hmm. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, those seem like really incompatible views of, like, don't try and be higher than other people, don't flaunt what you have. And to him, it was, let's show the success because they've worked really hard for it. And both are valid, but they seem super conflicting. So I'm curious to know, did they come to a compromise, or do you find a completely different solution that's win-win for both rather than a compromise?
Well, sometimes it can be either. But if you even know that the reason you're having trouble picking a car is because she doesn't want to be above herself and he wants to show the world they've arrived, if you get it even to that level of consciousness, you can begin to come up with possible solutions. But most of those reactions they were having were quite unconscious. She'd just be terribly uncomfortable in the Mercedes, and he would be elated and excited, and then they'd have trouble. The actual outcome, with what kind of car they get, they're a couple. They have to work out the car for them, and I don't know whether it's a Lexus or a Tesla or what it would be.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, this reframing, I mean, you can use it in so many areas of your life, not just in relationships with other people, but just the way that we view the world.
Yeah. And one of the things to talk about in the book is reprogramming your inner voice. All of us have kind of a silent, or not too silent, but to others it's silent. An inner voice that comments on our behavior and says, boy, that was a stupid thing to do, or hey, you really nailed that one, or something like that, and so on. Much of that self-talk, it's called, much of that self-talk is negative self-talk that we learned in our family. And in fact, I shudder sometimes when I hear a parent tell a kid he was really stupid. Because if you want to have a stupid kid, keep telling them they're stupid, and lo and behold, they'll program that in there. What we need to do is to reprogram the talk that we learned when we were younger. And sometimes it requires a conscious effort where you actually write out the belief that you want to program in there, and repeat it to yourself 10 times in the mirror first thing in the morning. Or I know some people have a rubber band they put on their wrist, and when they find themselves doing negative self-talk, they just give themselves a little tiny snap just to remind them that they don't want to let their negative self-talk take over.
Beautiful. We're speaking right now with James L. Creighton. He is the author of Loving Through Your Differences, Building Strong Relationships from Separate Realities. His website is publicparticipation.com. And we're coming close to the end of the show. I'm wondering, James, what do you feel like is something really important you want to get across that we haven't covered yet about the book?
Well, the big thing is the attitudinal shift that has to take place up front. Kind of right at the beginning, you start with conflict, that the name, the point in when you have a fight, is, as you said earlier, is to win. And if you start with that, you'll end up with winners and losers. And one thing you'll learn about a fight in a relationship is that every time you win, you lose somewhere else. Because it'll bounce back at you somewhere.
Oh yeah.
The idea behind this is that it is possible to arrive at a solution that both people can agree to and feel good about, and so on. It may take some work, and sometimes if it's a really important issue, it may take a few months for couples to work things through and try to figure out how to reframe it so that they feel good about it, and so on. But if you start on the assumption that we have a problem, you may get there. If you start on the assumption that the other person is the problem, it's going to go from bad to worse. And so that's the one key concept I'd like running through this would be the idea of all of these skills and all of these concepts are designed so that we can solve our problem.
Jim, I'm curious, how often in your practice do your clients come up against deal breakers? Maybe they've been trying to sort this out for months or years. It could be something like, I want kids and he doesn't, yet we're already married. How often does that kind of thing come up?
It can come up. Now, I don't anymore do private practice. So I mostly teach classes and things like that. And so I hear about these, but I don't have to personally wrestle with them. You may need to go to a therapist so you can both feel listened to and both feel understood and so forth and so on. And I don't have any predetermined answers for whether a couple needs to separate at that point or whether they hang together and reframe the situation or they adopt a child or something like that. I don't know. I just know that the process remains kind of the same.
All right. Beautifully said. Thank you. And is there anything else you want to add before we close the show?
Well, I'd love to have people look for the book. And even better, if you buy it on one of the major booksellers like Amazon or Barnes & Noble and so on, buy it and send them a customer review. This helps me and it helps other people decide whether or not the book was worth reading. So Barnes & Noble, Amazon, IndieBound, which is the Association of Independent Bookstores, they're all places where you can get the book.
Beautifully said. Thank you. And again, we've been speaking with Dr. James L. Creighton. He's the author of Loving Through Your Differences, Building Strong Relationships from Separate Realities. And you can find his website at publicparticipation.com. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you to James. And thank you for spending this hour with us. I want to send you so much love. Be well. Namaste.
The Crane Library is looking for student volunteers to record textbooks for those who cannot use print at the university. If you are a UBC student who is computer literate with an ability to read university material aloud and you have a willingness to learn new techniques, we ask for a 2-hour commitment once a week. For additional information and to set up an audition, call 604-822-6114 or email crane.volunteer@ubc.ca.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theatre, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theatre, visit their website at www.riotheatre.ca.
Good, and I've been wanting to find out more about local music.
Yeah, I heard about it through CITR and Discorder.
What's that?
It's a radio station. You can review all the music that comes in and help out with touring bands or just do some data entry to get started in their music department.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you can just email volunteer@citr.ca and they can help you get into the station or just come in whenever.
Well, I'll be there, so...
Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
if you take the chance to trust, start to open up, you just might. Show me what you really want. Tell me what you really need. Reveal all you feel. You will be received. You don't have to hide away all the things you really want to say. There are others who have felt this way. You're not.
We are so happy because Fun Drive 2019 is officially over. What a great feeling. To everyone who donated their time, their energy, and their money, the people who forgot to donate now but will online at citr.ca/donate, those who couldn't donate this year,